And I'm Kim Blair.
And I'm Eddie Amos, and this is Virginia Technology Today. Virginia Technology Today is a news and public affairs feature of WFIR to inform the local community on what's happening in terms of technology here in Southwest Virginia. You know, Kim, the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted our world in ways that many of us could have never imagined. Our healthcare workers and researchers are literally working around the clock to develop new tests and vaccines, helping to combat the pandemic. One individual is on the front line of this battle is Dr. Michael Friedlander. Dr. Friedlander, as you know, is the executive director of the Fralin Biomedical Research Institute at the VTC and also the vice president of health services and technology at Virginia Tech. Dr. Friedlander, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with the audience today.
Well, thank you, Eddie. It's really a pleasure to be here. I couldn't think of a topic that's more on everybody's minds today than this one, affecting all of our lives. So it's my pleasure to be here and have a chance to talk with you about it.
Mike, you're right. Everyone is interested about what we're going to talk about today. And first, let's start with how are you and the rest of the VTC Health Science and Technology campus and all the researchers that are working with you?
Well, I think we're all doing well. People are working hard, but this is what these folks do. They're all passionate and dedicated people. This is the kind of thing they do. They do science, they do research, they do biomedical work. And while this may not be exactly the format that most of us are used to working under, we're used to working in a more paced type of a standard academic research environment. It is certainly the sort of material and the topic that is something that we're familiar with. We have a lot of expertise, and so people know how to deal with the stresses and so forth. But, you know, I'd be disingenuous if I didn't say this has added a whole new level of stress to everybody working on this. They're working literally around the clock, sacrificing personal family time, other aspects of work, but they're doing it because they want to and because it's important, and they're all absolutely committed to doing this for our community.
Mike, there's a lot of research going on around the world, and a lot of folks don't realize how much is going on here locally in Southwest Virginia. There was a recent press announcement that came out last week about Go Virginia funding to aid your group on various testing initiatives that you're working on. Could you provide the audience an overview of what your team is working on in terms of testing?
Sure. So as I'm sure most of your listeners have heard, the information that will be absolutely critical to beginning to move our country forward, and that includes the economy, as well as education and social interactions, et cetera, is data on exactly where is this disease, who has it, who doesn't have it, who might have had a response where they've had it already and perhaps would be protected. So it's this sort of information that we have to scale up and be ready to use the absolute best technology and the most precise, accurate ways of testing and provide it on a scale that it's useful to our leaders, leadership of our university, leadership of our city, our county, our state, our nation. So we've been working very hard to try to bring up to speed a number of these tests and provide it to the area and the region. We can't produce enough of these to take care of the whole state, obviously, but we're trying primarily to serve our region. So one of the things we've done is stood up a test for the virus itself. And of course, the public's heard a lot about this. When they hear the word testing, what people are often talking about are these either a drive-through clinic or a drive-up place or your doctor's office where you have a swab in the nose and a sample's taken, and that's then sent to a lab somewhere to be analyzed and determine if you have an active case of the virus. And so we are doing the tests behind the scenes, not the actual collections, but we've developed the laboratory testing with our own protocols here to analyze the samples we get, for example, from the health departments. The other thing that we're working on, and this is in very early stages, is beginning to develop the appropriate, what are called serology or antibody tests. The ability to evaluate people with a very small sample of blood and determine if indeed they've been exposed to the virus, and if they have they mounted an antibody response? Having said that, we are not very sure, and I mean we across the entire world at the moment, what it really means to see those antibodies. Does it really mean somebody is protected from getting infected again? And if so, for how long? And that requires more research. So the Go Virginia grant that you referred to was one we stood up recently to get some help from the state to begin setting this up and also to bring online a workforce training component. So Go Virginia is obviously very committed to growing the economy of the Commonwealth, and they fund the sort of things that help train workers for, you know, good paying jobs and important technology. So as part of all this, we not only have our people at Virginia Tech working on it, but we're also bringing in others, including recent graduates from some of the programs in the community colleges and the universities in the area, to train them in these technologies. And then they can work with us and even later go on and work with somebody else to do the same thing.
Mike, how can you go into a little bit more detail for the listeners about how the program is actually set up to be conducted here in our region and how many individuals you hope to have tested?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think there's often a bit of misunderstanding about how this works. The public hears that maybe they can go someplace and just get a test if they feel like getting tested, or maybe they need to go to their doctor, go to the health department. So let me try to clarify how this works here. The way we're working is we at Virginia Tech at two sites now, here in Roanoke at the Fralin Biomedical Research Institute at VTC, and in Blacksburg at the Fralin Life Sciences Institute on the main Virginia Tech campus, we have stood up labs here to do the testing. Now, we do the analysis. We don't actually collect samples from patients. So somebody would not drive up to the Fralin Biomedical Research Institute in Roanoke and say, I'm here to be tested. We don't do that. What they would do is either have a sample collected by the health department, and that could be in the Roanoke area, the Roanoke-Allegheny Health District, or near Blacksburg, the New River Valley Health District, for example. So they're collecting samples from various sites. Sometimes they go out to facilities such as a congregate living facility, like a nursing home, for example, or a mental health facility, or even a jail, things like that. And they collect a bunch of samples. So the collection is done by the health districts, the health departments. They then send those samples to us at Virginia Tech, and we distribute them based on capacity and workload between the Roanoke and the Blacksburg labs, do the analysis, then we report back to the health departments, and they in turn report back to the patients, or in some cases, they'll report back to a hospital or a health system. So our local hospitals who need local testing can send their samples to the health district, and then we'll analyze those. The numbers, Kim, are ramping up. So at the moment, we've just started off in the last week, and so we're trying to keep things under control, and we're testing between 80 and 160 samples a day right now. Depends on workflow at the two sites. But we are going to be ramping up to double that within a few weeks, and by the time we hit sort of early mid-summer, we hope to be to well over 500 samples a day. 1,000 a day is our goal, but we don't want to promise that at this moment. We need more equipment, instrumentation, and more workers to train to help replace the people here at Tech that are doing this round the clock.
Mike, I was recently helping a couple of companies on their business continuity plannings and disaster recovery plans. And a year ago, if I would have put something like prepare for a global pandemic, they would have probably looked at me like I was a crazy person. But today's reality is we're facing it. How are we doing here in Southwest Virginia in terms of preparedness?
Yeah, well, that's a question that I think you could ask for the entire nation for that matter. I don't know that we're dramatically different from other parts of the state of Virginia or for the rest of the United States for that matter, but trying to keep it at a local level. I think one of the things that's a real strength here that I've noticed, there's a phenomenal sense of community pulling together. I personally have never lived any place quite like this, where people will literally drop everything to help others in a situation like this. And I mean people dropping their, you know, their daily work and doing other things and so forth. So even though that may be counted more on the soft side, not in terms of dollars and infrastructure, we're really talking about behavior and culture. I can't emphasize enough how important that is. So in that respect, I would say Southwest Virginia is really positioned in a very strong way just because of the nature of can do and will do, what I see all around me and people in all sorts of walks of lives. Having said that, we do have extremely good academic institutions here, including Virginia Tech and others. And by virtue of having research-intensive mainstream large universities, you do have a lot of technology at hand. So for example, we've been talking about the testing, and that's a very important part of this. But as you know, also, there's been a tremendous lack of filling the supply chain for materials for healthcare. And that includes things as what we would think as simple as masks and gloves and so forth. But that's a real problem for our first responders, our healthcare providers. So again, at universities like Virginia Tech and other universities and colleges in the region, we have a lot of expertise, a lot of intellectual ability and technical know-how to do things like make PPE, make masks, make gowns, and so forth, actually manufacture them using modern computer-aided design technology, 3D printing, et cetera. And even, for example, at Virginia Tech, we have one of the premier testing labs in the nation run by Dr. Lindsay Marr that can evaluate these things and make sure they're working. So in many ways, by virtue of the community, the culture, and the environment with the health systems and the academic institutions and expertise and infrastructure, I'd say we're as well prepared as many places.
That is excellent to hear, Mike. And you referenced earlier the supply, the critical supplies that we need, the PPEs, the masks. Recently, you led an initiative very early on in helping to collect the critical supplies needed for our health workers on the front lines from local universities, from your colleagues across the valley. How are we doing in terms of critical supplies?
That's a very good question. And the answer is it's evolving. We're doing better than we were, but we're not nearly where we need to be. As you referred to, Kim, early on, we just put the word out to our colleagues across the campus asking for available materials. And I was amazed within about 48 hours at the boxes that started arriving. And those included masks and gloves and all kinds of things, goggles, shields that people were finding various places. And we immediately transferred those to our colleagues at Carilion Clinic. And I know they were very appreciative and it helped them. And the greater community, even beyond Virginia Tech, has done this. So again, that comes back to that culture thing I was talking about in this area. You can't really emphasize that enough. Where are we now as a nation and locally? We've improved. There have been a number of things happening at the national level, politically and economically, where you have industries that are shifting to production, for example, and we're actually starting to see some of that. Some of the challenges remain because when it comes to testing, for example, there are big laboratories around the country that can buy up a lot of material, and they've been doing that. And so a lot of us that aren't quite at that scale, when we go out in the marketplace, and that would include places like universities or smaller companies, or even state or local governments for that matter, and health departments, we're competing against these big organizations who kind of get a corner on the market. And so we're still seeing supplies we need to do the test, for example, are backordered by several weeks. So we're putting orders in advance to get as much as we can, but it's still a challenge. I think we're going to get there over the next month or two, but we're still not really there.
You know, there's a lot of information and misinformation in the world today about the pandemic. Dr. Fauci, this morning, of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, continues to warn us about reopening too soon. You saw where the governor of California is going to shut down the beaches. The University of North Carolina college system announced they will reopen this fall along with other states. Can you discuss the risk and how you think life's going to change for the average person moving forward?
Yeah, this is the big question we're all wrestling with, right? Everybody wants very much, I think, to open up, as it's called, and get back to some sense of normalcy. The economy is very much depending on that. But I think everybody also equally or more so wants to make sure to protect the public health. So this is a classic case of balancing risks against rewards, right? And a lot of people are running models and doing simulations. And ultimately, you can put all the data you want in the model, but somebody in a leadership role for the nation, for a state, for a city government, for a university, et cetera, for some group of people are going to look at those data and say, we can tolerate this much risk, but there's this much gain, and make a decision. And so I guess what I'm saying is there's no precise and perfect numerical answer to what you're asking me. It takes very thoughtful people, people that consider the ethics of the situation, the impact on public health, but also the other impacts, the economy and so forth. And it takes data. And so you can have all the ethics and all the thoughtful people in the world you want in the room trying to make that decision. But if you don't have accurate data about how the disease is spreading and who's become immune to it and so forth, you're kind of shooting in the dark. So there's a big push on nationally and here as well to collect as much data in an ongoing way as we can to make sure we feed that into the models and inform the decision makers. I think ultimately what it's going to come down to is, can we identify the people that are really at the highest risk and create the appropriate system around them to protect them? There's never going to be 100% protection guaranteed for everybody, but protect them at a very high level to really reduce and minimize risk for people who would be at higher risk anyway, but allow those that are lower risk to operate in an environment with all the public health strictures in place, social distancing, masks, people that have been exposed not being coming in, people working in different environments with clean hygienic spaces, et cetera. I think, and this is my opinion, that we as a society will come to an equilibrium point where we balance those things. But again, it's very important for people making those decisions to realize there will be risk and there will be loss and cost to human health and human life. And at what point do we balance those things? So those are the decisions a lot of people are working on now. I expect over the course of the next month or so, they'll be rolled out. I only hope that people don't move too quickly in places and without paying very close attention to people at risk, because otherwise the consequences could be devastating and we could have a spike in the return to where we were and we'd literally be starting over.
So Mike, for our listeners in our audience, What can they do to help you and your fellow researchers that are battling this crisis?
I think the best thing people can do is to, number one, stay informed. And I say stay informed by following the most accurate information you can get. Unfortunately, no different than in any other time of crisis, I guess, in history. There are people that take advantage of the situation. That comes in many forms. There are people who take advantage of it by spreading misinformation, inaccurate information. I don't need to be specific there. I think most people know what some of that is lately, and that can be a great damage to individuals and populations' health. So stay informed. Go to sources you would rely on. If you think about it, you've already mentioned leadership at our National Institutes of Health. These are people who are absolutely committed their careers, and they're scientifically informed medical leaders, Health and Human Services, Center for Disease Control, and get the latest information about how we all should be behaving and acting. And then follow that. You know, we hear a lot about wearing masks and what types of masks and so forth. Well, if you think about it, when we're asked to wear a mask when we go outside, that mask is generally not going to be what's called an N95 mask, the mask that would protect us from the virus coming in, the kind of mask a frontline healthcare worker should have, or a first responder, for example, or somebody working in a lab working with the virus. That mask is simply a way to prevent us from spreading what we may have to our fellow citizens by the larger droplets that through a cough or breathing and so forth. And so we have to have people that realize we are all in this together. It's said a lot, but by doing that, we protect our fellow citizens. And if we all protect our fellow citizens, we're all wearing masks, then we're helping out. The distancing, I can't emphasize that enough. People should stay informed and follow these. Don't get carried away when the sun comes out and people are feeling good and seeing some of the numbers go down and start getting together closely, because the same thing is going to happen again. Absolutely. And so people have to be informed, act intelligently, and with consideration of your fellow citizens. It's not just about us as individuals. It's about our neighbors and the entire community.
Mike, thank you for the work that you are doing, our fellow researchers here at the Fralin Biomedical Research Institute, all of our frontline medical professionals that are doing everything that they can to keep us safe and providing us insights this morning. We look forward to having you back on the show. I thank our executive producer, Joey Self, for making this show possible. And until next week, I'm Kim Blair.
And I'm Eddie Amos, and this is Virginia Technology Today.